came across this problem. He said, suppose you're given a triangle, and you choose a point on the three sides, and you draw a line with the opposite vertex, like so. You got a little triangle in the middle. And the question is, how big is that triangle relative to the bigger triangle? So in other words, what fraction of the total area is comprised of this little triangle? And in particular, the problem was, suppose you choose these three points at random. This one, and this one at random. What's the average size of this? Now, I'll make that a little bit more specific later on, but I want to continue with the story right now. Well, the suggested answer to that particular problem was 1/7. In other words, on the average, this is 1/7 of the whole, which looks nice because there are seven pieces into which this is divided. I thought it was an interesting problem. I didn't make an effort to verify it at that time long ago. But then I came across this book a couple of months ago. I read this book by Kai-Li Chung, who's one of the gurus of probability science, of probability theory, Green, Brown, and Probability. And I came across page 102, which I handed out. And the underlying thing seems to be essentially the same problem. At least I thought so on reading it the first time. And it rekindled my interest in this problem. And I actually sat down to try to find out, to verify that 1/7 was the answer. And as it turned out, 1/7 wasn't the answer that I got. I did this problem, in fact, two different ways, and I got the same different answer than 1/7. So it struck me that Chung was actually wrong. And if you read this little blurb, you notice there's a story involving Chung, who was having lunch with the great physicist Richard Feynman, and he told him that's what the answer was to this problem, and Feynman began doodling on his napkin. He says, no, I don't get this answer. So I figured that Feynman was right and Chung was wrong. But then I went back about a few weeks ago and reread this particular section of the book, and it turns out, if you read carefully, that Chung is talking about a different problem, slightly different. And what he's saying is not that these points are chosen at random, but if you go 1/3 of the way along here, 1/3 of the way along here, and 1/3 of the way along here, then this thing in the middle is 1/7. So that's a different problem, because there's no probability involved in it. That didn't even occur to me, because this is occurring in a book on probability. So, but in any case, his answer turns out to be correct, so that's why I entitled this talk, Chung Vindicated, because he's only being vindicated from my false opinion of what he was doing. Chung Vindicated, rather than Chung Corrected, which was my original intention. Here you go. Okay. So now let me, first of all, try to formulate the problem more accurately. I have to state what I mean by these points being drawn at random and specify the problem. Okay, suppose we take, let's say, I go along this side, alpha. Now, alpha is going to be 1/3 in this case. It's going to be the fraction, not the length, but the fraction of the length that this point is down. You can actually measure it from this side either. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so let's say this goes 1/3 of the way down, or whatever it is, alpha. This goes 1/3 of the way, or whatever it is, 2/3, and this gamma. Okay? Now, it's clear that this relative area in here is going to be a certain function of alpha, beta, and gamma. Okay, let's call that T, the triangle. So it's going to be T of alpha, beta, gamma. A rather complicated function which I won't write down. Now, choosing at random. To say that alpha is being chosen at random is, first of all, it could take any value between 0 and 1, and uniformly in that interval. In other words, any interval of 1 with epsilon is as likely as any other interval.
Is it equal to that triangle?
No. Any
kind. So why is it equal to 1?
Say this again?
Why is it equal to 1?
Oh, because it's a fraction of the
fraction.
It's a fraction of 1. So, no, actually. shape of the triangle doesn't matter at all in this problem. As Chum points out, he says trying the equilateral triangle, but that's what it is in Delkenny. Okay, so this is a fraction of length, and alpha is chosen uniformly between 0 and 1, beta also, and gamma also, and they're chosen independently of each other. Now what that means is that you've got a cube which can represent alpha, beta, gamma by something inside a cube. Let's see if I can draw a cube here. Okay, there's my cube roughly. And let's say alpha is going in this direction, and beta is going in this direction, and gamma is going in that direction. So you have a point inside represents a triple alpha, beta, gamma, cube one. And you can draw that uniformly anywhere inside the cube. And that's what you mean by drawing at random. And the question is, what's the average value? That turns out to be just an interval in this case. So that's what you have to evaluate. So that would be the average value of that triangular area relative to the area of the whole triangle. This approach turns out to be hopelessly complicated, at least for me. Therefore, what we have to do is to find another, more clever way of solving this problem, and that brings me to barycentric coordinates. And it turns out, in fact, that this particular, I think the procedure is more important than the problem itself. The problem itself is just, you know, a nice thing with no particular applications. But the procedure of barycentric coordinates, in my opinion, has a great potential. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is talk about the nature of barycentric coordinates. Now, bary is the Greek word for heavy, and barycentric coordinates means what you're going to do is assign weights to various points, and what that is representing is the center of gravity of those points. For example, let's take a line. Suppose I want to put coordinates on this line. Well, typically you choose an arbitrary point, call that 0, choose another arbitrary point, call that 1, and just go through the usual process of assigning coordinates. But another more symmetrical way of doing it is the following. Suppose I put a weight x on this point and a weight y on that point, and I require that they add up to 1. And you can think of that, just weights on these. Think of the center of gravity of this particular configuration. This weight x over there and this weight y over there. For example, if each one is a half, that gives you this center. This is 1 and this is 0. That would be this point over here. This point has no weight, so it's 1 over there. If this is 1/3, thirds, you're going to get a point roughly there. Intuitively, is it clear what's going on? And you'll notice one thing over here, that the more weight you put on a point, the closer the center of gravity is to that point, obviously. And as a matter of fact, if you think of the relative sizes of this and this, this is 1/3 and this is 2/3. In other words, the relative lengths of this point relative to the original points is proportional to the opposite. This is 1/3 over here, that's going to be 1/3 over there. This is 2/3 over here, this is 2/3, and this is going to be 2/3 over here. So that's a general feature. I might just say that there's no reason why these both have to be positive numbers. They have one of them being negative. For example, if I put a positive over there and a negative over there, I can represent points on this side of the line. And vice versa, if I put a negative here and a positive here, that represents on this side of the line. This particular problem won't involve that. But I'm just stating that in general, barycentric coordinates can be negative. They can both be negative, of course, because they add up to 1. Having started with that, I should mention that the creator of barycentric coordinates is Möbius. Back in the 19th century, whose best known for the Mobius strip. Okay, now, let's go a step further. Let's go to one extra dimension. I want to represent points in a plane, and I can do that by assigning numbers x, y, and z to the three vertices over here in such a way that, again, for example, if I assign 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, I'm going to get the median of the plane. Okay, now let me, and I should mention also, you can have a negative, some of these components could be negative. In fact, you have seven possible sine patterns, plus, minus, 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 plus, plus, plus. You can have minus, 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 of course, and say, again, roll that up to one. And that corresponds exactly to the fact that if you extend these lines, you chop the plane up into seven pieces.
Then you can have them all negative, and you would just assume negative masses, so gravity pulls up.
I'll think about that. Okay, so anyway, let me give a few more properties of barycentric coordinates over here. The case where all of these are plus corresponds to the points in and on in the triangle. In other words, I'm only considering this where all the weights are positive. Outside over here, one or more of these things is going to be negative. Okay, here's another property of barycentric coordinates. I can do it by pieces. I can, first of all, let's say go to x and z, and forget about y, and just find the center of gravity of this point, these points x and z. What of course I have to do is to normalize them so they add up to 1. So let this be z over x plus z, and let this be x over x plus z, and that's going to give me some point like so. And then, the second stage of the process, is to find the center of gravity of this point and this point with weights y and 1 minus y. So in other words, the overall average is the average of the averages, so to speak. Any questions about this? Okay. Third property is the following. Let's go to this triangle again. And barycentric coordinates the x, y, and z. And let's suppose that the point is with that particular center of gravity for those three points. Suppose I draw these three lines. That the areas, relative to the triangle as a whole, the area of these three triangles is z, x, and y. Notice that's a kind of generalization of what I said before. If you're on the line, and this is, say, 1/10, 9/10, then this thing over here is 1/10, and this thing over here is 9/10 relative to each other. Over here, if you look at the opposite, over here, the area of this triangle is the same as this point opposite the area of this triangle. Now, how do you go ahead showing something like that? Well, like this. Extend this line and apply what I did before. Let's see. What I can do here is to average this x and z. This point over here is going to be the average of, first of all, I average with respect to x and y to get this point over here. Then I average with respect to z and this point. Let's call this point Q. Q is the average of these two points with weights x and y. And then this point over here is the average of these two points with weights z and one minus z. Okay, now, consider this area relative to the triangle as a whole. They both have the same base, therefore the ratio of their areas is the ratio of their heights, so it's the ratio of similar triangles, the ratio of this to this is the same as the ratio of this to the whole thing. Okay. And from what we said before, when you take the average of this and this, the relative lengths are going to be z and 1 minus 3. And therefore, this is z. The ratio of this to this is z to 1, and that's the ratio of this to this, and therefore that's the ratio of this area to that area. Okay? Any questions about that? You have to sit down and think about it for a while, but indeed that is the case. So, that's all we have to know about barycenter coordinates to solve the problem that I've given over here. I'll just mention casually that barycenter apply to any dimension. They even apply to infinite dimensional space in some sense of a classical effect. Okay, now, what's the clever way of doing this? Well, we can erase this any point. And this little thing, you notice that we have two triangles over here. Okay. We'll write S1, S2, and S3. And if I could find a way of finding the average value of S1, S2, and S3, I would be able to find the average value. Of course, in terms of areas, that comprises the entire triangle. So, if I take intervals or everything, or expectations, incidentally, I'm going to call this expectation. So that's expectation of this triangular area. Then I have the expectation of this, plus the expectation of this, plus the expectation of this, plus the expectation of that, equals 1. And there are two great advantages of doing this. First of all, it's almost obvious that these are going to have the same expectation. And secondly, S1 depends on only two of these three things. It depends only on alpha and beta. If you've got this point over here is determined by beta, this point over here is determined by alpha, and it's only those two things that influence S1. Gamma doesn't matter. And that's the key to doing things globally. Okay, now, let's in fact erase everything except S1. And try to figure out the average value of S1. Okay, and to do that, what I have to find out is what is S1 as a function of alpha and beta, and then I take the expectation with respect to alpha and beta. Okay, well, if you compare this to this, you see that what we need really is just the z coordinate of this point over here. In other words, I know that the area of that triangle relative to the whole is going to be z, which is the barycenter coordinate up here at this point. So what I have to find is, if I call this x, and I call this y, and I call this z, all I have to do is determine the z that corresponds to this point up here, and I have to get. Okay, well, I'll specify, I'm going to measure alpha down in this direction, I'm going to measure beta in this direction. It doesn't matter if I measure beta down from here or up from here, then 1 minus beta, since beta is uniform, that's the same distribution as 1. So I measure them down like so, and first I want to find the ratio of x to z. Anybody see what that is in terms of alpha? Well, remember I said when you take a relative weights x and z, you get a point like this. This is proportional to x and this is proportional to z. And that means that here's this point over here. There. And the ratio of x to z is going to be the ratio of alpha to 1 minus alpha. minus alpha alpha bar. For this, the area of this triangle, S1, the relative area, relative to the triangle of the whole, in terms of alpha. let me, at this point, let me turn back to Chung and his problem and demonstrate that what he said is correct. So, I mean, this is not trivial, because after all, it did plummets the great Richard Feynman, at least over lunch. So, the situation would be this. Remember, I said you go one third of the way down over here, one third of the way across, and one third of the way up. Draw these two things, and show that this thing in the middle is 1/7. Okay. So, alpha would be 1/3. Beta would be 2/3. So I have to plug in 1/3 and 2/3 into this formula. 1 over 1/3 over 2/3 plus 2/3 over 1/3 plus 1. Each element of it as an exercise, that's 2/9. So the expectation of S1 is, that's not an expectation, there's no probability yet. This is 2/9. This is 2/9 by symmetry. This is 2/9. Oh, sorry, 2/7. Oh, oops, you're right. Okay. That's what it turns out. Yeah, this is 2/7. This is 2/7. This is 2/7. 6/7 leaving 1/7. That indicates chunk. Okay, and a little bit easier if in fact you manipulate this stuff a little bit and it turns into alpha bar, beta bar over 1 minus alpha beta. That's a little easier to see because this thing on top is 1/3 times 2/3, so that's 2/9 divided by 1 minus, this is 2/3 times 1/3. That's a little easier to see. Okay, so Chung is vindicated, but we haven't solved our problem yet because all I have is the area of this for a particular value of alpha and beta. What I have to do is to now take the expected value of alpha and beta. In other words, we have reduced things to the calculus problem. And in other words, denominator. So this thing over here,
integrand,
the n goes from 0 to infinity of alpha to the n, beta to the n, and we have to stick in our numerator, alpha bar beta. And I have to find the expected value of this, in other words, the double integral of this expression. Well, we now invoke the principle that the expectation, all of these terms are positive numbers. The expectation of a sum of positive terms is the sum of the expectations. There are standard theorems in prior analysis. That monotone convergence theorem, the Wien's theorem. In other words, this thing over here is the same as this series of terms is absolutely convergent, which means I can rearrange terms as I like, and I'll get the same sum. And in particular, I can take the summation of these three parts of it. So what I get is squared plus 1 over 2 squared plus 1 over 3 squared, and that is pi squared over 6 squared. Theorem of Euler. So this first term over here adds up to pi squared over 6. How about this last term? Well, right, it's the same thing except we left out the 1 over 1 squared. So that second, that last term over there is pi squared over 6 minus 1. Okay, now how about this middle thing? Well, let's over 1 minus 1 over 2. This is 1 over 2 minus 1 over 3. 1 over 3 minus 1 over 4. And as you say, telescopes. And some of the first n turns is 1 over 1 minus 1 over n. And therefore, it converges to 1. So, Feynman didn't get anything. He just said it wasn't 1/7. At least it doesn't say in that that text doesn't say what. I'd be well, if he got it, he'd be wrong, of course, because that's not the same problem that I'm doing. Right. So expectation of S, and then finally expectation of T equals 1 minus 3 times the expectation of S1 because we have S2 and S3 are the same, and that's. It's not much different than 1/7. 1/7 is about 0.14, but you won't get any points on the button right now. 1/7. Well, yes.
I'm sure you know that parasitic coordinates are the way that we deal with primary and quaternary systems, both in standpoint and phase diagram, and also the space numbers. We have more change of practical terms. We refer to that as the Weaver rule, the inverse Weaver rule.
That's L-E-V-E-R.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about barycentric coordinates because, as I said, I think they're more interesting than the original problem, at least more important than the original problem. And what you're getting at is that they're actually a very neat way of representing mixtures, mixtures of up to three things. Because here's a point in a triangle. Well, how do you do that? You think of it as point over here is a mixture of let's say three different metals in an alloy, maybe something like that.
Right.
I might also mention that economists use this. Just to throw in something from my old formal profession. In the following way, suppose that you have three possible choices. And you want to represent various probabilities over A, B, and C, the space of all probability distributions over A, B, and C. Well, a probability distribution is just, of course, three numbers X, Y, Z adding up to 1. So there's the barycentric part. And also non-negative. Non-negative, that's the extra ingredient that probability adds. But that's exactly the point inside this triangle. well, when you forget about the rest of the plane, and you just concentrate on this triangle over here. So one third, one third, one third, of course, would be the median of the triangle over here. And so forth and so on. So this is a very neat, compact way of representing the set of all possible probability distributions over three items. Let's say x, y, z. Well, 1, 0, 0, for example, the probability distribution which assigns probability 1 to the point A would be just this point. That has very central coordinates 1, 0, 0. This is 0, 1, 0. This is 0, 0, 1, etc. So you've got the set of all possible probability distributions over here. What's that mean? Well, one thing is expected utility theory, something you may have heard of. And expected utility theory says that there exists a set of numbers utility here such that rational people would choose among alternatives by maximizing the expectation of this particular utility function. Well, if you try to translate this into geometry, you know that economists like indifference curves. Okay, I don't know. I don't want to go into that one, but you've got choices represented by indifference curves and preference orders. The expected utility theory essentially boils down geometrically to the statement that the indifference map consists of a bunch of parallel straight lines. And this goes on for quite a while. Okay, let me just for fun, take elementary geometry. Suppose the three sides are A, B, and C. You know, there's a whole bunch of standard points like the median, the center of the inscribed circle, the center of the circumscribed circle, the ortho center where the algebra is meeting, and so forth and so on. Each of these points somewhere on this plane, most of them inside the triangle, but not all of them. And therefore, they all have very central coordinates. For example, again, the median, the example that I gave before, has very central coordinates 1 third, 1 third, 1 third. The way to see that, by the way, is the tool that I mentioned. First of all, we'll take these two points alone and forget about this third point. That's obviously going to be the good one. And then, take the weighted mean of this point and this point, it weights 1/3 and 2/3. That's going to be the point where this is 1/3 and that's 2/3. But you know, the medians of the triangle meet at the point where each of the lines at the opposite midpoint is trisected. So that's the way you get that, and you get the simple theorem of geometry. How about the barycentric coordinates of the inscribed circle? Well, if the three sides are A, B, C, they claim the coordinates are simply proportional to A, B, and C. In other words, they're proportional. You have to, of course, divide by A plus B plus C in order to make it all add up to one. But that indeed is the case. How would I go about showing that? Well, take each inscribed circle. Here's the point I'm talking about, the center of the inscribed circle. This is R, this is R, and this is R. Recall that the barycentric coordinates of this point are given by the areas of these three things. Okay, what's the area of this triangle relative to this triangle and this triangle? Well, they all have the same altitude, R. Therefore, the areas are proportional to the bases. Therefore, the area of this triangle over here is proportional to C, the area of this one proportional to B, and the area of this one proportional to A. Therefore, barycentric coordinates have to be A, B, and C. Okay, that's the way you do that. How about the circumcenter? Well, the circumcenter, it's more convenient to deal with angles rather than sides. Call it alpha, and gamma. And I claim the coordinates of the barycentric coordinates of the circumcenter.
under or proportional to sine of 2 alpha, sine of 2 beta, and the sine of gamma. And of course, you got to divide by the sum of those sines in order to make it add up to 1. And to demonstrate that, at least for points which are inside, basically the circumcenter is inside. Angle over here is gamma. Remember, there's a big circle surrounding here. And by elementary geometry, the central angle is twice this angle over here on the side. This is 2 alpha, and this is 2 beta. And let's take a look at these three areas again. The barycentric coordinates are proportional to those areas. Well, what are those areas? That R and R, that's the same for all three triangles. The area of that is proportional to this times the sine of that angle. And since the R's are the same, the ratio of these areas will be the same as the ratio of the sines, and I think that thing will fit. So that's that. I should also mention this. You notice that the incenter, A, B, and C, all of those weights are positive. Obviously, the inscribed circle center is always inside the triangle. For the circumcenter, it's possible for one of these weights to be negative because, let's say, remember, it doesn't form sine 2 alpha. Well, if alpha is bigger than 90 degrees, this is negative. Right? And that is exactly the case where the circumcenter lies outside the triangle. So that gives you that. Okay, and finally the other side.
And what's the picture? So the proof is a little bit different.
Right. Well, I have to interpret what I mean by the area of those three triangles when the point is outside. So let's suppose I take a point like this outside.
So is it better to draw an obtuse triangle? So
well, I'm just taking any arbitrary point, not necessarily. In this case, this will be plus, this will be plus, and this will be minus. That's going to give me this region over here. This entire region is characterized by those signs. And what you do is, okay, so let's say there's x, which is positive, here's y, which is positive, and here's z, which is negative. Again, it adds up to 1. Here's this triangle over here, which is on this base. That's going to be proportional to y. In fact, relative to this original triangle, this is going to have area y. Positive. Y could be bigger than 1. So this area could be bigger than the original triangle. This over here, this area, is going to have area x. Also positive and could conceivably be bigger than the original triangle. And finally, this triangle over here is going to have area z, and the way you recognize that it's negative is that it's pointing on the opposite side. In other words, ones are on the inside of the triangle, so to speak, they're pointing inward, but this one is pointing outward relative to the side. So that's how you recognize this thing over here to be negative. Again, if you take a look, if you just add them up and count this triangle out here as a negative, it's you get y plus x minus the absolute value of z, so you get this as a net value. So this it turns out to be real neat in terms of how it got wrong. Yes?
There's another possibility then, right, is that nether region that's bounded by the two lines is 11 here.
Yeah. You've got 7 regions altogether, and that corresponds exactly to the 7 possible sine combinations. Let's see, back to my original triangle over here. here corresponds to this being a plus and these two being minuses. And we've always got something here. And you can try, you can try duplicating that diagram again. As it says, you're going to have two of these things with negative area and one with positive area. So in other words, let's say you have, positive area, and you have to subtract off two things with negative areas. We have to roll that color stroke over here. Okay, this thing over here is going to have a negative area, and this thing over here is going to have a negative area, and when you net everything out, you get the original triangle. So you get that. And how about in three dimensions? Well, if you take a tetrahedron and extend the four faces of that tetrahedron so as that it slices up all the space, you get how many regions? Don't try to think about it geometrically, think about it barycentrically. 15. That's right, you can't have all four minuses, but every other possible sign combination is going to correspond to the points in that region. So you chop the tetrahedron up, the tetrahedron extended, chop space off into 15 regions. Exactly. Well, that's not good. Nice to do it that way. Okay, well.
Does the same method work to time?
I haven't figured out a good way of even thinking about the problem, let alone solving it. Research project, I suppose. I'd know what department it would be in. Okay, well, I could go on to, let me just mention the Oracle Center since I've got a triangle. The point that the altitudes meet is the Oracle Center over here. And if this angle, the three angles alpha, beta, and gamma, again, the barycentric coordinates of the orthocenter are proportional to angles. Angle alpha, angle beta, and gamma. Let's see, is there a clever way of showing that? And of course, you have to divide by the sum of the angles in order to make it all add up to one. A clever way of doing that. The following, call that H, call this little piece A, call this little piece B, and I get H over A equals tangent alpha, right? And H over B equals tangent beta. And therefore, let's see, A times tangent alpha over B times tangent beta. I think we should reverse the name of the equator, so I'm going to divide through by AB. Now you recall that given the two weights over here, this thing is divided in such a way that this is proportional to that weight and this is proportional to this weight. But that's exactly what this says. It says that B is proportional to tangent alpha relative to A being proportional to tangent beta. So the relative sizes of this and this must be tangent alpha and tangent beta. That constant is rough. You'd have to polish it up a bit, but that gives you a rough idea of how to go about it.
That's why we call it the inverse Cleveland rule, because it's the distance on this side is related to the other distance on the moment.
Okay. I thought Lieber might have been the founder of Lieber for this.
No. Okay.
All right. But in any case, that's the way you do that. So those are the main kinds of points you get there. Okay, let me, if you'll indulge me a little bit more, I mean, what can I run through?
Six.
Okay, six. What I want to do is to
give some of the wider implications of this barycenter thing, and in fact talk about a little kind of big project that I'm engaged in, possibly with a collaboration in the future of Bob Drugrat. And the idea is this: what I want to do is to, first of all, the concept of a simplex. In one dimension, a simplex is just a line segment. In two dimensions, a simplex is a triangle. In three dimensions, a simplex is a tetrahedron. And in general, in n dimensions, a simplex consists of n plus 1 points, such that they don't all align at one angle. It's kind of intuitive feel for this. And the question is this: we know all kinds of things about the triangle, loads and loads of theorems about the triangle. How many of those theorems carry over into the general case? Okay. For example, every triangle has a median. Does that work in general? Well, that, of course, depends on how you define median. But the one simple way of defining it is one that gives equal weight to all numbers. So by definition, this is equal. Is there always a circumcenter? Is there always a sphere, a hypersphere, through which all the vertices pass?
Any of the finite points will turn it bigger than the
Say this again?
Any four non-finite points will turn it bigger.
Well, that's correct. So the answer is yes. There is one and only one. Let's see what other.
That works in five dimensions as well.
It works in any number. Let's see, how about an inscribed circle? Well, yes. As a matter of fact, there's always an incenter, and it's unique also. And in fact, the reasoning is exactly the same as I did over here. Remember that the reasoning said that the sizes of these three things are proportional to the lengths of the sides. For a tetrahedron, the barycenter coordinates are proportional to the areas of the vortex. Generalization exactly the same type of volume as that. So there always exists a unique incenter. How about an orthocenter? Is there always a place where all the medians meet? No. That turns out to be a condition for which you can do that, which is maybe orthocenter. Okay, now it turns out that questions of this sort are ideally suited, I believe, with the use of barycenter coordinates. And what you have to do is this. See, the problem is, typically, the most powerful instruments at the disposal of mathematicians are, vector methods, Hilbert space, inner products, and all that kind of stuff. But that's not natural for geometrical type problems. Geometrical type problems would like to use the metric properties. In other words, if I have a n simplex in n minus 1 space, what I'd like to do is define these properties in terms of the distances among these things. And that's not easily represented in terms of vector properties. But barycenter coordinates essentially give the way of doing that. And I can just set up the problem in the following way. Suppose that I have a simplex in any dimension, and I take two systems of barycenter coordinates, let's say A1 to AN or AN plus 1, I suppose, because I'm doing the N plus 1 points, so B1 to B, N plus 1. Okay, and I want an expression for the distance between these two points in terms of the given distances among these n plus 1 points. So I'm given a metric. I have n plus 1 points, I'm given a metric of all of these points. And I want the formula in terms of that metric to tell me the distance between these two points represented by the barycenter coordinates. Okay, so how would I do that? Well, first thing I can do is subtract from the other. Intuitively clear that this distance coordinates add up to zero, rather than one. Because then these add up to one, these add up to one, you subtract them, you get a bunch of numbers that add up to zero. And it turns out that the following is true. But A, the n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrix of the spread distance is four. A is going to be like this. Aij equals distance from point I to point J. That's the matrix of sorry, square. These are all the square distances. And it turns out that what you do is this. Let's call this expression C1 through Cn over all that C. It turns out that the square distance between these two is simply minus a half. A nice simple formula for distance between any two points in terms of their barycenter coordinates, nice simple way of doing that. And once you've got a general way of representing metrics, then you can go ahead and do geometry. The C is the difference between, in other words, here's the barycenter coordinates for the first point, barycenter coordinates for the second point. You subtract this, and you get, so to speak, the direction.
So it's the same as A1 minus B1 vector?
Yeah, right. It's the same as the A1 minus B1 vector, C. But of course, the C's add up to 0.
But that would be nice if this would be the same as the other way. Plus one effect.
Well,
I didn't know if it was the type of that was part of it.
All right, I was doing that.
Your right hand is down near the C.
Oh, right. Good point.
I was just wondering if I missed something else.
Oh, I understand. No, that's the way it is. And there's a general formula. It doesn't look like, this has to be positive, right? It doesn't look like it has to be positive, but there's no way it comes out to be positive. Assuming that this is actually a metric which can be embedded in n-dimensional space. You know, you can find metrics which can't be embedded in n-dimensional space. And what one needs is a criterion. I presume this is a criterion for when you have a metric when it is embeddable in dimensional space. For example, here's four points, and there's the distance among those four points. Okay, that's a perfectly legitimate metric, and yet I would defy you to embed that in two-dimensional space. 1 plus 1 is 2, so in three-dimensional space, this point would have to lie simultaneously on this line, and this line. Okay, so what you need is a criterion for when a given metric is embeddable in three-dimensional space, and I'll just mention what that is. Everything ends up being expressible in terms of the same metrics. Okay, here's your A metric. Square distances of all of the points. Take it. The border is a bunch of ones and a bunch of ones and a zero over there. And then you take a look at these determinants. So you start at one corner. I'm not quite at the corner, but two by two days. And you look at the determinants over here. And the signs of those determinants have to hold. Necessary and sufficient condition for being able to embed a measure in one. Once you've got that, yes.
Do those determinants have to be taken from the lower right corner?
No, well, that can be taken from the left corner. I mean, you know, if you think about it, symmetry, you could arrange them in any way whatsoever. But, I mean, what's nice about this is that I could take this. The original matrix A, scramble up the rows and columns in any way I want, in other words, give them any kind of order I want, and redo this. And the alternating signs over here for one order will then determine that the alternating signs for any other order are in the same order. let me just build up a few terms.